Yeah. Birkas HaBozo, in other words, benching after the meal, but also, as I said, even the brachas that we recite for food before the meal can be recited in any language, not necessarily in Hebrew, but again, we say mitzvah min hamuvchar, which means that to fulfill the mitzvah in the finest way is to do it in Hebrew.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
We're deviating a lot tonight. They have the appetizers at the
food mart.
Dinners, no, our dinners.
Oh yeah.
We're eating
right
before that.
Right.
But then shortly after you sit down to eat, so that doesn't count then that you've eaten.
Supposed to watch before you.
Okay.
See.
All
and
right.
Then they everybody gets up and say the motzi and you know.
Okay. All right. That's a very simple question. Okay.
Yeah. I always felt that one or the other should be before.
Yeah, I would agree with you that in general it probably would be better to wash beforehand and make hamotzi, and then you could eat whatever you want. That would be the preferred way to do it.
Sure.
But it doesn't have to be done that way. It could be done the way you do it over here, but what it means is then that you have to make individual brachas for the different foods that you pick up. I mean, whether it's a dip or whether it's a knish or whatever it may be, and so you make an individual bracha. But you could also have in mind that eventually, you know, instead of making then the bracha right afterward, you could have in mind that you will eventually wash, and then in the birkas hamazon that you recite after the meal, so you have in mind whatever you have eaten before. But that's the way. But you shouldn't eat without first making a bracha for whatever it is that you're picking up. Naturally, if I have three or four of the same thing, you don't have to say it each time. Once would be enough for that. Okay? But that would be the preferred. There's no question. This is why in some places they have a washing station and little pieces of bread, you know, that's over there,
yes,
so that you can immediately wash, make a motzi, and then go to town. Yeah, right. Okay. No. Mizonos will cover things that are made out of flour, grain, and so on and so forth. Okay? But it will not cover fruits or vegetables or anything like that. Pardon me?
It's all in one plate. The same Mizonos covers everything in the plate.
No, technically it wouldn't. Wouldn't. Unless you're talking about, let's say that you have a stuffing inside, you know, and then in that particular case, it's already a different story.
Yeah.
Okay? Because that falls into the category of making the bracha over what is the important thing, and automatically it includes what is the, you know, the less important thing that's inside. Okay? Okay. Shavuos Ha'Edus. Shavuos Ha'Edus means that people see some event that took place and they have to give testimony. Therefore, they have to take a vow, they have to take an oath before the court that, you know, what they have seen is correct. In other words, you solemnly swear to this and that, you know. I mean, you see it in the American system as well, okay? So that's what it's saying. Now, Shuas HaPikodon, this is a slightly different thing. Somebody has asked you to take care of whatever it may be for him. Remember I said before, there were no banks in those days.
Mm.
So let's say that he was going on a trip and he wanted to make sure that when he got back he would have, let's say, a certain amount of money over there, all right? So let's say that he deposited $100, $1,000, whatever it may be, with you, okay? Now, if that money isn't there when he returns, you have to take an oath, you know, that you didn't embezzle it.
Or steal it.
Yeah, steal it, whatever. I mean, embezzlement is anyway, it's like stealing. So for that, you have to go to the business and take an oath and so on. And so that's what they mean by Shuas HaPikodon. All right, so far, these different things mentioned can be said in any language, not necessarily in Hebrew. But now we come to things that can only be recited in Hebrew. The Yelon Ne'emorim B'Lashon HaKodesh. These things must be recited in Lashon Kodesh, in other words, in Hebrew. One of them is mikra bikurim, that when a person brings his basket of first fruits to the Beis HaMikdosh, he has to make a declaration over there, Arami Obed. First of all, he has to say, Igarati Hayom L'Hashem Lekecha, today I have vowed unto the Lord your God that I have come to this land, and these are the fruits, you see, that I'm bringing. And then he has to say, after that, Arami Obed Ovi, you know, that a little passage that deals with the history of the Jewish people, beginning with the earliest fathers, and speaking about how they went down to Egypt. They were enslaved over there, and finally God brought us forth from there. And, you know, this we say, of course, in the Seder night as part of the Haggadah as well. And then it concludes by saying, Yato hinei vesis reishis pri ha'adoma, and now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you have given unto me. And then after that, he prostrates himself before the altar, and he leaves the Beis HaMikdosh. And of course, the Kohen has assisted him in the meantime in the business, because the Kohen has to put his hands underneath the man's hands, right? It's probably called the Heinif or Tnufa. In other words, you take it and you wave it, and you wave it, you know, like we do with the Lord. In other words, this way, that way, and up and down and so on. So this is Tenufa, okay? So this, the declaration that he has to make, you know, in a vases, Prishla Adoma and so on, or Egalti Hayom, this has to be recited in Hebrew only. And if he didn't know how to say it in Hebrew, doesn't mention over here, but it mentions in the Mishnah Bikurim, then in that case, they would be makri or so. In other words, the Kohen would instruct him what to say, and he would say after the Kohen these things. So that that way he wouldn't be embarrassed. And eventually they got into the habit of doing it for everybody, just to make sure that people would not be too embarrassed to come and to bring
the Kohen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. The Kohen, but not the Kohen.
Right. Then the Chalitza, you know, this is the ceremony, if you wish, wherein a woman who she lost her husband, right, and he has a brother, and so technically she is tied to him. This is what we call yibum, right? And he either marries her or he frees her. The ceremony of freeing her is called chalitza, because it's based on the fact that part of the ceremony is to take off his shoe, okay? Because lachalots means to remove something, take off something, okay? So this is chalitza. But at the same time, she has to make a declaration at the time. She has to say, you know, that may this happen, you know, to anybody, to a man who refuses to raise up his brother's memory in Israel, refuses to give a name to, you know. So that being the case, and then everybody says, Chalutz HaNoal, Chalutz HaNoal, Chalutz HaNoal, so that all that has to be done in Hebrew. Okay? Then, Brochos uKlolos, the Brochos and the Klolos, this is in reference to when the people of Israel came to Eretz Israel. They were commanded that half of the tribes were to go up on Mount Gerizim, and half the tribes to go on Mount Ebal. The Kohanim and the Levim and the Ark, they're in the middle, excuse me, between the two mountains. And then they had to recite. So first the Kohanim said, blessed be the man who has not, for example, made any idols and bowed down unto them, and everybody has to say, Amen. And then they turned in the other direction, and they have to say, cursed be the man who has made idols and bowed down to them, and everybody answers Amen. And these, actually, we have the list of the klolos in Parsha Kisavo, towards the end of Deuteronomy, but it's understood that if we have the klolos, we also have the brachos. The brachos would be the opposite of the klolos, okay? Last week, I told you, you know, we used the chumash. So it's clear, you know, if you jump around the Chumash and take a look and see the original Pesukim. Okay, so these Pesukim of the Brachas and the Klos also had to be in Hebrew. Then Birkas Kohanim, of course, this is the Berechecho. This has to be recited only in Hebrew. Uvirkas Kohen Gadol, when the Kohen Gadol officiated on Yom Kippur, he had prayers that he recited on behalf of the people of Israel, and after reading from the Torah, he had a special group of brachas that he recited. Some of them we still recite as part of our own service, but others, were, let's say, pertain to the avoda, to the sacrificial service on the Beis Hamikdash. I mean, if you examine, for example, the idea of Ritzei, what does Ritzei say? Pray to God, right? That he should be happy, Be'amcho Yisrael, at least for the psalm, right? The people Israel and their prayers, Yehoshevus Avoda, Yisrech, Yisrael, Yisrael, and so on. And restore the avoda, restore the divine worship and the offerings that the people of Israel used to bring to your temple, okay? So the way it reads, since the destruction of the temple, is that it is a prayer that this may be restored again, be brought back again. But in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, it was a prayer that God should simply, be pleased and accept the offerings of the people of Israel, you see. So we can see, what the prayer originally was and what the prayer became after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But at any rate, what the Kohen had to say on Yom Kippur, this he had to say in Hebrew. This would also include, it's not mentioned over here. Here they only mention the brachas, But, if you take a look in the Mishnah in Yuma, where they have the service of Yom Kippur, so you have those passages, where it's written the Hakohanim, the Yom, and so on. Well, first of all, the Kohen had to make confession and say, "Oh no, Hashem, right? Kotosi, Ovisi, Poshati Lufanefa." In other words, I have sinned. I have committed all kinds of transgressions before the.
Is that in the Yom Kippur service?
Huh?
Is that in the Yom Kippur service?
Yeah. Three absolutely
seconds.
Right. Three times.
Seconds.
Right. First, he has to confess for himself. Then he has to confess on behalf of the Bnei Aharon, and finally has to confess on behalf of all the people of Israel, the sins. And then it's written, Vakonim Yehoam, right, that the Kohanim and the people who were there in the temple courtyard, the Azora, when they would hear the priest, the high priest, pronounce the name of God in the original pronunciation of God's name, what we call the Shem HaMeforash, right? So then they would all prostrate themselves on the ground, and they would say, "Bo Shem Kved Balchusa," and so on, okay? So that, and he would conclude by saying, on this day, "Kivayom Azei Chapa Aleichem," on this day, atonement will be made for you, "Lifnei Hashem Tid Horo," and you will be purified before God. So that when they heard this, "Lifnei Hashem," you see, this is when they prostrate themselves. So he had to do this in Lashon Kodesh, in Hebrew. Okay? Then we have for Shas Hamela. This is what we call the ceremony of Hakel, wherein, after the Shemitah year, during the Sukkot of the eighth year, people would gather in the Beis HaMikdash, and there they would put up a platform, and the King of Israel would read selections from Sefer Devarim to the people. And so I don't have to tell you what an awe-inspiring situation it was when the king himself got up and he read from the Torah, and thousands and hundreds of thousands were there, men, women, and children gathered in order to hear the divine words from the king himself. And then for Ashas Egla Rufa, this is, remember that the Torah says that if they find a body, they don't know who committed the murder, so they have to measure and see which is the nearest town to where the body was found, and then the elders have to come. They have to slaughter a heifer, which was never put into any service, and so on and so forth, and then they have to make a declaration. What is the declaration? It's written, "Onu v'yomru, yodeinu lo shofcha es hadom hazeh." Our hands did not shed this blood, v'yeinenu lo ra'u, nor did our eyes see this murder taking place. And then they continue with the prayer, "Kapeli amcho Yisrael shabbadis l'Hashem." give atonement, O Lord, to your people whom you have redeemed from Egypt, and let there not be any more any shedding of innocent blood in the land. Okay? So all this had to be done by the Zekanim, by the elders of that city, together with the Kahanim who were stationed over there as well, right? What language? That should have to be in Lashon Kodesh. Okay. Alright. Then the next thing is Moshuach Milchomo Ve'esha Medaber El Ha'ad. The Moshuach Milchomo. You had in the Beis HaMikdash Kohanim who had different ranks. Okay? One of the Kohanim actually was always the Kohen Gadol, okay, the high priest. But he also had others who were members, you know, of the higher Kohanim of the higher status, okay? One of them, for example, was called the Sagan. Sagan means literally like a vice Kohen Gadol, okay? So in case the Kohen Gadol, for example, became incapacitated, so then the Sagan could carry on until such time that the Kohen Gadol was restored to good health and was able once more to function. Okay, another person whom they would appoint is that in time of war they had a Kohen who almost had the status of being a Kohen Gadol. Literally he was anointed for the war. That's what Mashiach Melchama means. And then he would go to the assembled Jewish forces and he had to say to them the words of the Torah, which say that you know, if a person, for example, has gotten married within this year, then let him return home and rejoice together with his wife. Right? If he built a new house and hasn't yet had a chance to live in it, and so on, let him return, and so on. Same thing with a vineyard, right? Exactly. And then finally, he also said, if there's anyone who is afraid, soft-hearted, in other words, you lack courage to go and so let him return home so that the other people, the other soldiers who are there, should not become disheartened as a result of his example.
That's interesting.
Right.
Here we have people they call them deserving.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Here they gave him the opening.
Yeah. So that being the case, again, how did he address them? The answer is he addressed them in Lashon Kodesh when he made this following declaration. Okay. Now, the Mishnah continues by now breaking it down into some of these various categories that we mentioned. Mikra Bikurim Kesan. The case of the recital that you have to say when you bring the first fruits, how does this work? So, okay. The Torah says, "Be oniso v'yomarto l'fnei Hashem l'kecha." Now, notice the wording. The wording here contains two different verbs, right? One is be oniso. Usually, the word oner in Hebrew means to answer. Here, I wouldn't say that that's really the real meaning of the word in this particular section. It means that you have to make a declaration. In this case, the Yom Marton, you have to say, Lifnei Hashem Lekecha, right? So, on the basis, because it says, V'yonisa V'yom Marton, so therefore we know what? That this is one of the situations where you have to recite it in Hebrew, Lashon Kodesh. Well, Halon Hu Omer, because a little bit in another pasuk, there's another section in the Torah. What does it say? It says, "V'yonu halevi'im yomru," that the Levites will literally answer, as I say, will declare. It's probably a better translation, and say, and so on. So, mala halam b'lashon hakodesh. So, just as in the latter case, it has to be in lashon kodesh. So, afkam b'lashon hakodesh. So, here too, it has to be in lashon kodesh, based on the fact that it's written what? V'yoniso v'yomarto, or ono v'yonu v'yomru. Okay? Chalitza. Now how about the ceremony where the Yevama becomes freed from her brother-in-law? So, Ketzot, how is it, you know, that it's in Lashon Kodesh? So again, what is the wording? It says we onsa v'yomra. So again, what do we see? We see the same two words used, right? In other words, you shall declare and say. Well, a halon hu amer, and just as we saw in another situation, v'yonu halvim v'yomra. So just as mala halon v'lashon ha-kodesh, even as there it is in Lashon Kodesh, though afkan v'lashon ha-kodesh. So it means that here too it has to be in Lashon Kodesh. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda doesn't disagree with the fact that she has to say it in Hebrew, but he draws it from a different pasuk. He says it's written over there, the onsa, the omra, right? So she has to say, she has to declare and say, kocho, right? In this particular way. Since the stress that really he's putting on is the fact, the pasuk reads as follows: V'onso v'yomro kocho yeyoseh lo ish, right? Which means she shall reply or she shall declare and say, thus shall be done to the man, right? So he says it isn't just based on the fact that it's written V'onso v'yomro, but what do we find right next to that? The word kocha. So kocha means it has to be done exactly in this way. That's what kocha means. Like following way. Alright. Ad shatomar b'lashon hazeh. In other words, whatever she has to say has to be in this language, namely in Lashon Kodesh, according to the formula that the Torah mentions. Brachos uklolos. Ketzad. What was the situation with these blessings and klolos? How did that work out? So he says, Kevin Shaover Yisrael Sayardain. When the Jewish people crossed the Jordan River, Uvo El Har Grizim Yel Har Evel, and then they came to Mount Grizim and Mount Evel, Shebe Shomron, which are in Shomron. If you've ever taken a trip to Israel, you know that when you come to the city of Shomron, well, actually it's not the city of Shomron, it's the territory of Shomron, but actually what is the city? The city is the city of Shechem, which now the Arabs call Nablus, based upon the Greek name that was given to it, okay? So, at any rate, when you come to the city of Shechem, so you see, there's a mountain there and a mountain here, right? So this one is Mount Gerizim and this one is Mount Ebal, okay? So we know that this is where it has to be. Shebet Sav Shechem, he says, you know, which borders on Shechem. Shebet Eitzel Elonei Moreh, which is also the same as Elonei Moreh mentioned in connection with Abraham Avinu.
So you can tell which is which and which is Abel.
Yes.
No.
Very interesting observation. Mount Gerizim has vegetation on it. Mount Ebal is bare of vegetation.
Well, that's why I got the clothes.
Right. So, you know, the blessing, right, the blessings were on the one which had the vegetation on it, okay? And the clothes were on the other one. So when you go there, you see it, you recognize it, okay? Because today, Mount Gerizim is also famous for something else. Namely, we have a group of Jews called the Shomronim, Samaritans, or sometimes they were referred to as Kusim. Remember the Gemara, it speaks about Kusim, okay? So these are people who are Jews, but at the same time their Jewish religious practices are kind of mixed in, so it's not 100% kosher, okay? Their center is Mount Gerizim, and every year Pesach, what do? They build an altar over there and they bring a Korban Pesach and they eat it over there. So this they still practice to this very day, that they bring the Korban Pesach to Mount Gerizim and they eat it over there. That's how they celebrate their Pesach. Because, you know, they don't observe the laws that we observe. They observe only what their interpretation of the Bible is, and that's it.
When the kingdom was split, the Jews didn't go south.
Well, you're talking about the time when the kingdom was divided after the death of King Solomon.
You know that.
All right, unfortunately, Jews, even in those days, had a tendency to split and to argue and fight with each other and so on. What am I going to say? But, from our point of view, the temples that were built by Aaron ben Avot in Bethel and in Dan, you know, were the wrong kind of things, but nevertheless, Jewish worship was carried on over there. Okay? You understand what I'm saying? It wasn't right, but according to their lights of Judaism, it was. Okay?
Just going back a little bit, I'm trying to apply. Vanis, Vanosso, that's the difference of the female.
Onso, onso, right. Onso is the,
that's the same
feminine
word,
form. Onno, the verb, you know, would be Onno. He, Onso, she, and then Onu, they. That's the nature of all verbs where the root letter ends in he. If I wanted to say, for example, he bought, you say who? Kana. All right? She bought would be he, kanta, you say. And they bought would be him, kanu. Okay? That's the nature of these words. Okay. So they came to Mount Rizim, Harebon, Shom, right, and beside Shechem, which is near Elone Mamre, right? Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Halo Hamor be'Ever Hayadeh. In other words, these mountains are on the other side of the Jordan River. But remember, when Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the people of Israel, on which side of the Jordan was he with the people of Israel?
West.
Right. He was to the east at that time, what is now the kingdom of Jordan.
East. Absolutely.
Right.
Oh, yes.
So,
absolutely.
Naturally, so these were on the other side of the Jordan because they are in the west. Okay, West Bank, they use a dirty word. Okay. Well, Ahalan, who am there? In another passage, what do we find? What? They are both in what we would call the West Bank. A term that I don't consider a legitimate one, but simply from the point of view of trying to picture, is it to the east of the Jordan or is it to the west of the Jordan?
Well, technically, it's actually Israel.
The mountains were there. What Joshua did was to lead the Jewish people across the Jordan River and to conquer all this land which would be west of the Jordan.
I didn't know that the Yids went in there to Israel before Joshua left. I mean, actually, if they went on the two mountains, they were in Israel before Joshua.
No. Moshe Rabbeinu gave instructions as to what would happen after they crossed the Jordan. Okay? Because where did Moshe Rabbeinu die? He died on the east, to the east.
No, west,
No. He died into the east. Right.
East.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. Mount Nebo,
yeah.
Which is actually among the mountains of Moab. Moab was on the other side of the Jordan River. But, you know, later this all became Eretz Yisrael completely because, remember, 2.5 tribes said, they would rather stay on the east side of the Jordan. They didn't want to cross over to the west because they liked the land. It was good pasture land and everything else. And Moshe Rabbeinu had a whole argument with them, but finally they said, look,
we'll fight
we'll, together with the others. We're not trying to chicken out. We'll fulfill our obligation then come back to this land. So he gave them that land. Okay. And the fact is that throughout history, that was considered part of Eretz Yisrael. Granted, that from the point of view of the Talmud, there were different areas, and each one had its own ruling. Okay, in other words, you had Yehuda, you had Shomron, you had the Galil, right? And then you had what we called Ever HaYarden, the other side of the Jordan. So that you have different rules pertaining to them. Okay. But nevertheless, it was all Jewish territory. It was the British government, after the First World War, that decided that they had to make a place for an Arab king, so they took it away from Eretz Israel, which had been promised to the Jews, and they gave it and they created what they called the Kingdom of Transjordan. Later they changed the name to Jordan. So that's how it developed. But nevertheless, that was Jewish territory too in those days. All right. Well, the Halan who were there, in another passage it says, Vayava Abram Boretz Abdekum Shechem Adelamore, that Abram wandered about in the land until he came to the place of Shechem, until he came to Elon Moreh. So, Ma Elon Moreh Ho Mul Halon Shechem. So just as Elon Moreh, which is mentioned there, is really a reference to the Shechem, so Hap Elon Moreh Ho Mur Khan, so likewise Elon Moreh, which is mentioned in the book of Joshua as being the place where they came, and the Kohanim then went ahead with the ceremony of the Brachos and Klalos, so this is also Shechem. Okay. And what happened? So then the Mishnah continues, says Shisho Shavatim Olil Rosh HaGrizim, right? Six tribes climb up on Mount Grizim. Vishisho Shavatim Olil Rosh HaRevol, and six tribes climb on the top of Mount Evol. V'Hakohanim V'Halviyim V'Haron, and the Kohanim and the Levim and the Ark, Omdim Lamato, they stood down below, the Emsa, in the middle. In other words, you know, like in the valley between the two. Hakohanim Makifin es Aron, the Kohanim surrounded the Aron, the Halviyim is Hakohanim, and the Levim surrounded the Kohanim, the Chol Yisrael Mikanu Mikan. And the people of Israel on this side and that side. Shenemar, as it is written, this is a pasuk in the book of Yehoshua, the Chol Yisrael, all Israel, was Kenov, including their elders, Bishotrov, and their police force, Bishoftov, and the judges, Omdin Mizeh U'Mizeh Laron, standing on this side and that side of the ark. How could they do it? Because the answer is that it was surrounded completely on this side or on that side. Hotchu paneihem klapei hagrizim. So first, the question is, who turned? Well, it could either be all the people turned towards Mount Grizim, or, possibly a little more plausible, the Kohanim and Levim, they turned towards Mount Grizim. Ufotchu bevrocho, and they began with the blessing, Baruch HaIsh Asher Lo Yaseh Pesel Masecho, blessed is the man who will not make a graven image or a molten image, right? Ve'elu ve'elu unen omein, and everybody answers omein. Hofchu paneihem klapei harevel, then they turned their face towards Mount Evel, Fosu b'klol, and they began with the curse, Orur HaIsh Asher Lo Asher Yaseh Pesel Masecho, cursed be the man who makes a statue or a molten image, and then they answer, until they complete the listing of the various things that we say. As for example, one of the things that they said is, Arur Masig Vul Reyehu, right? Cursed be the man who removes the boundary of his neighbor. In other words, he takes away what belongs rightfully to his neighbor. So, if that's what they say, then they have to say, Baruch HaYish Asher Lo Yasigz Vul Reyehu, right? So, this is what it is. And they have other things, too, that they recite. as for example, Oru Matlo Aviviyimo, right? Cursed be the person who dishonors his father and his mother, right? And everybody says amen. So obviously, what would be the opposite? Happy is the person who honors his father and his mother, right? That's so this is
one of the
right, of course, there's a difference, exactly. So that we can understand that. Right. Or Mashke Yiver Badura. Cursed be the man who causes a blind person to stray or to stumble, you know, on the way. In other words, you have to help, not, you know, put stumbling blocks in place of that. So obviously, the bracha would be happy as the person who helps the blind on the way, or something like that. So from this we understand exactly what it is, and it also includes the, you know, adultery and other things like that. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're getting a long list of required ingredients.
Yes, right. Okay, so to continue now with the Mishnah. Okay.
Long Mishnah.
Yeah. V'achar kach, and after that, heviu es va'avonim, uvonu es ha-mizbeach, v'saduhu basim. This also we find in Parsha Kisovo, that they were commanded to take 12 stones from the Jordan, okay? And they were to set them up as a witness, it is like plaster, in other words, you know, plaster the stones, sort of like whitewashing it, okay? Whitewash the stones and then write on it the words of the Torah. Now, exactly whether they did the entire Torah or if they did only a selection from the Torah.
12 stones.
What exactly? 12 stones, one for each tribe, okay?
Whole Torah on one stone?
Well, according to one interpretation, that was it. According to the other interpretation, what they did was to write the brachas and the klolos on them, okay? So they brought the stones, they built the mizbeach, right? And they put, as I said, like whitewash on it, right? The chotz v'olov, and they wrote upon it, it's called Divrei HaTorah, all the words of the Torah, and what? B'shivim loshon, in 70 different languages, not just in Hebrew, but in every imagination. According to the tradition in the Talmud, there were 70 nations in the world, and each one had, of course, its own loshon. So therefore, they speak about shivim loshon, and, a person, in order to be eligible to be in the highest Sanhedrin, had to be able to understand shivim loshon. Why? Because if you have a defendant and he's fluent in language A and not language B or something like that, they have to be able to understand what he's saying. Shenemar, as the pasuk says in the Torah, ba'er heitev, which means you are to explain it very, very well. Now, naturally, how can you explain it? So the answer is you have to explain it in whatever language people understand. So that's why they say shivim loshim. Okay? Then after that, the notlos havonim, then they took the stones, the bowl, and they came, the lonu b'mekomo. Which probably means that it means that they took the stones then, they placed them where they would remain permanently in their place. So this was a memorial, was the people should remember, right, that on this great event that took place, and see the words of the Torah inscribed therein.
You're saying it was a concession too, that there were 70 languages among the Jews.
Mordechai, being a member of the Sanhedrin, also understood shivim loshon.
He was not, he was in charge. How could he be in the Sanhedrin?
He may have been in Persia, but maybe he also was part of the Sanhedrin Eretz Yisrael. Maybe he sort of shuffled back and forth. He did what Danny does.
They didn't have airplanes.
So he took a caravan back and forth. Maybe when he had an important case. So, but you know, this helps explain, according to the Gemara in the Megillah. You remember, he overheard two of the guards plotting against King Ahasuerus. So the Talmud wants to know, how come that they did it in the presence of Mordechai? So the answer is because they thought he didn't understand their language. They didn't speak Persian, they spoke a different language. They spoke Tarsian, whatever that is, the language of Tarsus or something like that, okay? And they thought that Mordechai didn't understand what they were talking about, but Mordechai, being a member of the Sanhedrin, so he knew what they were saying, and he was able to report it to Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king.
The Torah makes reference to the plains, maybe she says, because the pagan is doing
major
and the
wings
of eagles.
Yeah, so. Oh, I see, it's a reference to airplanes. Okay, all right. I don't know, maybe he took him out on flying discs or something. I don't know. But you have to understand, it's an expression. Okay? It's an expression.
You can broaden out the 70 name just because of dialect.
Right. And definitely, there's no question about that.
Right. Which is prevalent to this. Spoke the same language, the same Hebrew, and with a different idiom or inflection, like French Canadian, French.
Yeah, I understand. Region, of course. I mean, we know, even in our country.
Southern, even
right,
south.
Right. I mean, some of the expressions used in the south are not exactly what we would say up north. The old business, you know, what is tonic? Of course, the answer is that if you're living in Boston, tonic is soda. Go outside the area and you talk about tonic, you know, they think it's some kind of a medication.
When I went to the Army down south, I heard a lot of time, I'm waiting on you.
Yeah.
They had expressions.
Yeah.
A lot of the Boston, everybody recognized the Boston. They know you don't speak good English, a New Yorker.
Right.
I can recognize Baltimore, Baltimore, you know, the Baltimore.
Yeah.
There he is,
right.
Coming down.
Yeah.
The Sanhedrin, is that colonel still hope to be kept alive in the modern times?
I mean,
that
do we hope
happen?
That the Sanhedrin will be...
Is anybody ever thinking that?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. People were thinking that those terms, as soon as the State of Israel came into being, they were hoping that a Sanhedrin would be reconstituted again. Unfortunately, it wasn't. For various reasons. One of the reasons is that, you know, unfortunately, we have a tendency that, you know, I'm a great scholar and you're, who are you, you know?
Yeah, everybody's famous.
So that this doesn't speak well. But I remember Rabbi Shenkov, Olav Sholem, he would have been very happy to have a Sanhedrin. He was hoping for it, but it didn't happen.
Well, you have to say almost the stage of the Beth Din.
Right.
That kept alive the Beth Din.
Yeah. So,
just to figure that out, who's going to be which?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's part of the reason. But another more basic reason probably is the fact that the government of Israel was, by and large, run by the socialists. Let's face it. And they weren't interested in trying to have a Sanhedrin, you know, reintroduced. If anything, you mean that they wanted to have a secular state, you know. And so you can see that right from the very beginning, 50 years ago, the State of Israel, you have, you know, these counter tendencies, you know. Having Yiddishkeit, and then on the other hand, you know, having a secular state, not just non-religious, but among certain elements, actually, you know, some of them were really vehemently opposed to Yiddishkeit altogether. They hated Yiddishkeit.
You get all kinds of. I got a letter today seeking a donation from a fund, and their letter based it on the fact that, as Jews, do you want these ultra-Orthodox preventing, I don't know if you saw, I got one of those.
Well, I keep getting from the seminary, I keep getting all these things.
And they're trying to raise money about the issue of the of them, the domineering the religious.
Yeah. Very nasty, and that's not right.
I don't know.
I've got a lot of articles on it. You get the paper, but I have a lot of back issues talking about all this.
Yeah. Okay, let's at least get started a little bit on the Gemara before we call it a night. All right, Parsha Sota Menalan. How do we know that in the case of the what you know the Kohen says to the woman? How do we know that it could be in any language? So he says Dechsiv, because it's written what the Omar HaKohen Lo Isha, the Kohen shall say to the woman. Now I noticed before when we had the Mishnah, I stressed the fact that the Mishnah is playing. Is placing emphasis upon, does it say simply he said, or does it say Vyonisa Vyomarta or something like that? In other words, where the honor, the Omar, you know, is there, you see. So the Kohen says that he speaks to the woman. Actually, he speaks to her B'chol Lashon Shehiyo Shehu. He speaks to her in whatever language that he has to in order to help her understand what's going on. Okay? Tanu Rabbanan. our sages taught, Mashmiyin Oisa b'choloshon shehishamas. You have to let her understand whatever language she understands. Notice the word shomea means not only to hear, but also means to understand, and you have to understand it that way, you see. Almahi shows off, for what reason is it that she has to drink the mayim hamaorim, right? Uvamahi shows off, and in what kind of a vessel is she going to drink the mayim hamaorim? Alma nitmeis, in what manner did she become unclean? In other words, in what manner did she violate? Uvamahi nitmeis, and how, in what capacity she became nitmeis? Almasha he shoysa, for example, why is she drinking it? Because it's aliske kinu sisira. In other words, it's because of the fact that he had already warned her beforehand, and then she persisted and she secluded herself in spite of her husband's admonition not to, and so on. So this is the reason why she has to drink the mayim hamorim. Uvamo he shoysa, and then what is she drinking? B'makedah shalcheres, as we said before, they take just an ordinary piece of earthenware cup or something like that, and they put the water into it, and she drinks from that, rather than, for example, a silver kela or a golden kela and so on. Okay. Almai nitmeis, adultery, or at least she apparently committed adultery, right? Sal iske schok v'yaldus, it's because she behaved in a manner that all she was interested in was having a good time. That's the sechok, right? The yaldus, and she behaved in an infantile manner, right? And in which way did it happen? Was it bishogeg? Was it in error? Obemezit? Or did she do it purposely? Ba'enes? Was she forced into it? Oberatzon? Or did she do it gladly, willingly? The chol kach loma, and why all this? Shelo lahotzi la'as al mayim hamorim. It's in order not to cause a bad report concerning the mayim hamorim spread. In what way? So as Rashi explains, because if she decided that I can get away with it, then in that particular case, then it wouldn't have any. Then we would say that the Mayim HaOrim doesn't serve the purpose that it's meant to do it, and it should, be given the respect that the whole ceremony should be respected the way the Torah insists upon. All right, we'll do one more because it's getting late. Bidui Meiser. This we said was the declaration that you have to make that you've taken care of all the various tithes. Minalon, how do we know? Desiv, because it's written again. Right, you shall say before the Lord your God, Biarti HaKodesh Min Abayis, I have removed all the holy things that I am obligated, to give from my home. The Yalef Amira Mesaita, and we learn that the word Amira means in any language, and we learn it from Sota. V'chol Losho Shehu Omer. So therefore, since it's a similar expression to what we had over there, so if in the case of the Sota we've already established that it can be done in any language, so in that case the Vimaiser too could be done in any language that he understands. Omale Rav Zvid Labaye, so Rav Zvid said Labaye, V'leila Famira Milavim, why you say that it has to be in any language, but maybe we should learn it from what did the Levites do? Malahan min Kashon HaKodesh, even as in the case of the Levites, who had to make the declaration, the brachas, the clothes, and so on, we said that it has to be in the Hebrew, right? So, just as there, it's required in the Hebrew, in the Holy Tongue. So, Afkam Kashon HaKodesh, why shouldn't we say that the Vidui Meiser should also be in the Holy Tongue? So they say, Donin Amira Greater Saw, Me Amira Greater Saw. So the answer is, you can make a comparison where the word Amira is used alone from another situation where the word Amira, in other words, Omer, Viomar, Viomru, and so on, right, is there alone. But the ein donin amira greater so mi aniya v'amira. But we do not make a comparison. That is, we do not, you know, imply or learn from a situation where just the word amira is to be found, from where it's written, the onu v'yomru or aniya v'amira, as it says over here. Okay. All right, I think we shall stop at this particular point. And now, with next week, I have a problem. All right. We are on Lamed Beis. Let me just summarize briefly for the sake of those who were absent the last couple of sessions. I mean, what exactly is the inyan in this new chapter, okay? This new chapter begins by saying, Eilanei Amorim B'chol Oshon. These are things which are recited in any language, whatever, and then it lists other things that can only be recited in Lashon Kodesh. So, the first thing that they say can be recited in any language, whatever, is Parasha Sota. In other words, what the Kohen has to say to the woman who is suspected of being a Sota, he doesn't talk to her Ivrit if she doesn't understand Ivrit. He can talk to her in any language in order to help her understand, you know, what was the nature of what she is suspected and what justification there might be, and also to find out, you know, what her own reactions are and everything else. So you use the language that she understands, okay? So that's clear. Then the next thing that they went to is Vidui Maiser. Vidui Maiser, as we explained, this is the declaration that has to be made every third year in the seventh year cycle, in other words, the third year and the sixth year, when just before Pesach, the person who lives in Eretz Yisrael has to make a declaration that he's taking care of all the trumas and maisros and everything that belong to the Kahanim, to the Levim, to the poor people, and so on, and also the Maaser Sheni. You know, that which he had to eat in Yerushalayim and so on, that he's taking care of it all, and there's nothing more left in his house which is owed in the form of maisros and things like that.
So here's a question that occurred to me. Do the people, the poor people who get the tzedakah, okay?
Right.
Do they have to give also?
Yeah. Why not?
10%?
Also, they're expected to give 10%. We don't have a clear indication about that, but we do have a clear indication about the Levi, because the Torah says specifically that the Levi who lives on Maisris, but nevertheless, he has to give Trumas Maisr, he has to give also a tenth of what he receives to the Kohen. So, presumably, that even a poor person who has, you know, some sustenance coming to him, so he should also give.
No,
in other words,
somebody who's getting charity,
right,
to sustain his family.
Correct.
All right. Dispensation.
I don't know how much he would have to give under the circumstance, but if he has a little bit left over, it would be nice for him to share also with others. Why not? Gesund der Heid. After all, even the poor person should also practice the idea of tzedakah, even if it may be only that he can contribute a penny or something like that. But just the idea itself in itself is a mitzvah.
Huh?
It's an individual thing. You can't have anybody checking out.
Right.
Not that attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the question is whether you committed the edict altogether. If matzah has yet been taken from
that's
correct. At least you have to designate by saying that this is being set aside for Maaser or something like that. Yeah.
Right, but one would think that if Maaser had already been taken and the person is then given the bare Maaser money, then you wouldn't have, I don't think you could possibly tell at that point if you had been taken.
Okay, the minute that you designate, you say, you put aside, you say, this is going to be for Maaser or whatever, then in that particular case, from that point on, you see, you're permitted to make use of it. But you don't immediately have to give the maaser, you see.
No,
that can stay with you until
you
such a time that
point.
You give.
Right. But
yeah.
What I'm saying is that once the original owner, the person who had the fruit trees or whatever,
right.
once he's taken off his maaser, and then he's given the after he's already taken that off, then he gives the matzah to the onion.
Yeah.
Then the onion then owns that stuff. He
that's correct.
Give the matzah in order for his matzah to be cut off, does he?
Who?
The
onion.
No, who? The owner?
The onion.
Oh, the
onion. From his share.
Even the onion, the right thing would be for him also to set aside something. Yeah.
Yeah, but would it be tevel though? To eat it?
No.
He hadn't done it,
no. No, it wouldn't be tevel, but nevertheless.
If he ate it, it wouldn't be tevel.
Right. He should still, you know, set aside, as I say, because the idea, again, is that even no matter how poor you are, but if you have any possibility, you see, of giving, then you should cultivate the mitzvah of giving tzedakah. Okay, so the vidui maaser, again, as we said, then you can say that in any language, okay? This is what we said so far in the Gemara. Now, of course, the Mishnah I went through several times already.
Right.
But, you know, and as we'll continue tonight, so they're going to discuss it phrase by phrase. As, for example, Kriya Shema, Shmoneh Esrei, and things like that, and so on, okay? So this is where we are right now. And what we learned last week in the first few lines of the Gemara, up to where, you know, what we recorded, is that how do we know, for example, that the Kohen who talks to the woman, he can talk to her in any language, the Sota, right? So they say because it's written, the Omar HaKohen Lo Isha. The Kohen is to say to the woman. So say in any language, it says, B'chol Oshen, Shehu Omer, right? Any language that he wants to use for it. Okay. Then they bring in a Beraisa, which says, Bashmin Oisa B'chol Oshen, Shehi Shamas. In other words, they give it to understand whatever language that she understands. Amahishosa, what is she drinking for? Vamehishosa, what will she be drinking from? Amanit Meis, in which manner, you know, was it possible, you know, that she became, that she committed the sin against her husband? Uvamahinit Meis, in what way she did it? Because this is in order to, they explain, Amahishosa, for what reason does she have to drink the Mayim HaMorim and Sal Iske Kinui, in other words, because, you know, she went and she secluded herself after having been warned not to. So this is the reason why, if she wants to prove her innocence, then she has to drink the Mayim HaMorim. Uvamohishosa, and in what kind of a vessel does she drink? So it's for Makeda Shelcheres. In other words, in just an ordinary, like a drinking cup or something like that, made out of clay, you know, but you know, not in one of the, not in a golden vessel, not in a silver vessel, even though that's what they normally use the Beis HaMikdash, but not in this particular case. And Almad Nitmeis, for what reason was it, you know, that she committed the sin? Because it was Al Iskeis Choy Kriyaldus. In other words, she acted in a very immature way. She was out for a good time, that's a sechoik, or a yaldus, she was very immature, and that's why she did what she did. And here they want to find out, was it possible, you know, that when she committed adultery, but it was b'shoigeik, it was as a result of ignorance on her part. You would say, what kind of ignorance? So Rashi brings, for example, maybe somebody told her that, you know, the husband was away, and they heard a rumor that he died, something like that. And so since she figured she's no longer a married woman, so this is the reason why she did it, okay? Did she do it, you know, purposely, even knowing exactly what it was and so on? The onus of a ratzon, did she do it willingly, or did she do it because of the fact that, let's say, she was raped or something like that, in which case, of course, you know, it's not her fault and so on. V'chol kach loma, and all this shelo lehotzi las al mayim hamorim, it's in order not to bring any not to bring an evil report concerning the this water. Rashi explains it as follows. He says that if, because of the fact, you know, that she had been in error at the time, you know, when she secluded herself and so on, and she knows that the water is going to vindicate her, so she may get the impression that even if she had purposely sinned, so the water would still be, would vindicate her. I mean, it would be nothing. This is the reason why then it says, Shalola Hotzi La'as Alabai. In other words, not to bring about that people are going to have, you know, disregard for this whole procedure and think that the Maimonides proved nothing, you see.
If it was to show that the water would not do anything?
Not only it would not do anything, but she wouldn't even be required.
No.
If they would if they would recognize the fact that, you know, she was mistaken in that particular case, she wouldn't have to.
No,
right.
But the question is...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to clarify that. Because
right.
They don't want her to drink it in that situation, so that... For what reason? Because it doesn't... that she was guilty,
right.
Then she'll think that in other situations
right.
So in other words, the mind would not cause any problems if she had done a pishogi.
That's correct. Right.
Okay.
But she shouldn't get the impression that and she went ahead then and she did it purposely, that the water is never going to have any effect on her. That's what how Rashi explains that, okay?
So
yeah.
So she did it because of that.
Right.
She didn't understand.
Well, that's what the guy is trying to find out.
She didn't believe.
And
yeah.
You know, talking with her, as you know, he's trying to find out why is it, you know, that she got herself into such a pickle in the first place.
Mm.
And then to try to find, if possible, extenuating circumstances for her action. Okay? But at the same time, in order to clarify, I mean, if she maintains her innocence, then in that case, she should go ahead, you know, with the procedure. We've learned other cases where they don't even bother to give her, you know, the maimonides. I mean, if the woman refuses to take it, for example, then that's it. Husband gives her a get and farting. And if the husband doesn't want her to take it, it's the same thing. The only problem that we had is...
If he doesn't want her to take
if he doesn't want her to submit to the ordeal of the Maimon.
So what happens then?
He could divorce her. The problem is only whether he divorces her with the ksuba or without the ksuba, you see.
Well,
if it's his fault, then in that case she gets the ksuba.
What do you mean if it's his fault?
I mean, if he's the one who says, look, I don't want you to do it, then he should divorce her and give her the ksuba. But if on the other hand, you know, she's the one who refuses to do it, and in that case,
then she loses the
ksuba. Right, she doesn't have to drink the maimonim because, but she would lose the ksuba, you see. So that this is the situation. And we had other cases too, you know, whether we could accept the testimony, for example, of, let's say, a mother-in-law or a sister-in-law or something like that. If you remember, the question over there was, are they presumed to have some kind of animosity against her or not, and in which case then she would get the ksuba, because we suspect that with them there may be more. I mean, we can accept their testimony that they're not lying about it, but nevertheless, because we suspect that there is an ulterior motive over there, so in that particular case then she doesn't drink the she gets the ksuba.
Mm-hmm.
All right, these were some of the things that we learned in the previous chapter. All right, now what about Bidui Maiser? So he says, Benalon, how do we know? He says, Dechsev, because it's written, V'yomartov te'er shem lekecha, right? And you shall say before the Lord your God, V'yart te'er kodesh b'nabayis, right? I have cleaned out whatever is holy from my home, right? And the Yalef Amir on Nisota. And we learned from the fact that the word, that the Omar HaKohen, so we learned that the word Omar means in any language, so that therefore over here too, if it's written via Marco, it means also you can say it in any language. Okay? So that this is how we learn. So then Omar Goy Ramzvid Labaye, right? The Leila Amiro Milavim. So he raised the objection. He says, maybe the word, via Marco should be learned in connection with the Levium, where we learned, that the Levium are the ones who say the brachas and the klalas on Har Grizim and Har Evel, right? And there, the Mishnah says specifically that it has to be in Lashon Kodesh, has to be in Hebrew. So, why can't we assume over here then that this too should be recited, the Vidui Maaseh should be recited in the Hebrew and not in any language. So he says, and to carry the analogy further first, it says, Mala Halam Megillah Shana Kodesh, just as there in the case of Leviim, it's in Lashon Kodesh, so Avkandul Shana Kodesh. So that's when we have the last phrase that we had recorded over there, that Donin Amira Greater So, May Amira Greater So, that you can learn the meaning of the word Amira, in other words, saying Omer, Omar, Omarta, whatever it says over there, where it's not accompanied by any other expression. So that's the situation, it's parallel. But we ain't done in Amira Greater So, but we cannot make a comparison if you have just the word Amira, or Omer, whatever it is, May Amira, the Amira, where it says vi onu vi omru, or something like that, or vi onisa vi omarta, in which case we say there, it shows that it has to be only in Lashon Kodesh. Tanya. All right, so this is a new area now. Tanya, we have learned. Rabbi Shimon ben Yoicha Yoimer, he says, Odom Oimer Shivcho Bekol Nomuch Ugenusei Bekol Rom. He says, a man recites those things that are favorable unto him, that are praiseworthy in him, in a low voice. Ugenuso, but those things that reflect poorly upon him, Bekol Rom, in a loud voice. So the Gemara says, Shivchei Bekol Nomuch. The fact, that we learn that, those things that are praiseworthy in him should be said in a low voice. This we learn min vidui amaiser. Why? Because all that it says over there is what? Viomarta, that's all. So because it says viomarta, it means that he doesn't make a big display of it, right? It doesn't say it out loud, it doesn't make a big display of anything like that. But genusei bekol rom, how do we know that when it comes to reciting something which is not so favorable unto him, he says that in a loud voice? So this we learn in Bikurim, right? We learn this from what he has to say at the time when he brings Bikurim. So you'll ask me, what is the genus? I mean, what is the thing, that speaks not so ay-ay-ay, and that he has to proclaim? So the answer is, this goes back to what is the text. What does he say when he first brings the Bikurim? All right, the first thing that he says to the Kohen is, he starts in, first of all, by saying, he's grateful to God, I'm important, but then he says, Arami Ovid Ovi, right? He has to recite this, Arami Ovid Ovi. In other words, my ancestor was an Aramean. It's translated in various ways. Of course, the way the Haggadah of Pesach translates it is that Lavan the Arami wanted to destroy the entire Jewish people. He wanted to destroy my father, meaning he wanted to destroy Jacob and all his ancestors. Okay. It's not necessarily the pshat, but that's the drash. Okay. But the point is that what is the genus? The genus is the fact that if we take a look, we have ancestors who weren't Jewish. Where was Abraham descended from? Right?
Terach.
Terach was a goy. So that this is the genus, right? That, once upon a time we had ancestors, who were, as you said, I guess in dinner. In other words, an idolater. Okay? And as a matter of fact, in the Pesach Haggadah, if you remember, they quote from Sefer Yoshua, where it says, Joshua said to the people that on the other side of the river, your meaning in this particular case probably on the other side of the river Euphrates, okay? Yoshua v'sechem yerlam, that's where your great ancestors lived back in the old days. Terach havi Abraham, v'adinochor, right? Terach was the father of Abraham and Nochor and so on. V'yavdu alihim acherim, right? And they served idols. That's exactly what we say. So if that's the case, then this is the genus. And in the Gemara Pesachim,
what's
genus means that you know, saying like slanderous things or not nice things about something.
No.
Okay, about something or someone. So this is gnus. Okay. So the Gemara Pesachim, when they deal, particularly you know, with the order, the Seder for Pesach night, so everybody's in agreement that first you start with gnus, and then you wind up with sheva. So what is the gnus? So about this, there are two different opinions. Therefore, we incorporate both of them in the Haggadah that we recite. One of them is the one that we just mentioned, namely that once upon a time we had ancestors who were not the nicest people in the world. They were idol worshippers and so on. But finally, you know, after suffering all the hardships of Egypt, God took us out from there. And so on and so forth, and Lawalyde Malach, Lawalyde Sorof, etc., etc. Okay? That God took us out of Egypt, so that's our Shemach, okay? The other opinion that we have is that the Gnus begins with the words, Avodim Hoyinu Lufar Ben Mitzrayim. In other words, how did we. Shalom Aleichem David Meir.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Welcome, welcome.
But the gnus consists of the fact that first we say that we were slaves unto Pharaoh. So in other words, we remember again our lowly estate, right? This is the gnus in this case. But, you know, but God took us out from there with his mighty hands, outstretched arms, and so on and so forth, right? So that this, they say, is the start beginning with gnus and winding up with shevach. Okay, so
shevach meaning
with praise, praise. Praise. So that first, you know, we mention what lowly state we were, but then we wind up by praising God for the fact that He's made us into a free people. All right. So coming back, doing the same analogy over here. Okay, we say that the vidui meiser. Right? So, what do we say? There he says it, you know, Bekol Rom, right? He says it out loud. He says in a lowly voice because he's saying good things about himself. He says, look, Reino Shalom, I have taken care of everything. Biyate Kodesh Ben Abayis, I have removed all sacred things that are owed from my house. And then also he says, Le'avati Ben Mitzvesecha V'le Shachochti. What greater praise can he say? I have not transgressed any of your mitzvahs, and I have not forgotten. So this is praise. So therefore, he says only the omarta. That's all. Say it in a low voice, that the whole world doesn't have to hear it. Okay. Whereas when it comes to Arami Oved Ovi and Vayed Mitzrayim and everything else, in other words, when he brings the Bikurim, so there. He says it, the Kol Rom, in a loud voice. Of course, we learned, I mean, that in reality, the Kohen prompts him. This being the reason being because they did not want to shame anybody who did not remember the verses of Arami Ovidovi and so on. And so, therefore, the Kohen is mockery. He prompts him, and he says it together with him, and so on. Okay. But that's the Kol Rom. So now, they asked the following question. Omar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Yochai. But didn't Rabbi Yochanan say in the name of Rabbi Shimon Yochai? He says, Mipnei ma tiknut filo belachash. For what reason did they ordain that the Shemona Esrei should be recited silently? Could have been said out loud. Could have had a shul full of everybody screaming at the top of their voice.
Yeah.
Right, but they say Shemona Esrei, you really should not say it out loud. You should say it belachash, in a whisper, right? But why?
But
so he gets the following. Right,
huh? Supposed to be able to hear it.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that we derived, right.
Moving your lips without sound is not doing it.
Absolutely right. I mean, this we learned, remember, in Brochas, where we learned that the paradigm for this is the story of Hannah.
Right.
Where it's written, you know, that she was just saying, you know, softly to herself, Rak sefaseho dois, it's written over there, only her lips were moving, the keila lo yishoma, but you could not hear her voice. So from this we learn that from Chana's conduct over there, this is the way Shemona Esrei should be recited. But for what reason? This is what they bring over here.
That contradicts what we just said.
Yeah, of course, absolutely right. It is a contradiction. So he says, the reason why we say Shmonesra Belachash is Kedei Shadodi Vayesh Esofi Avera, right? It's in order not to embarrass people who have transgressed and who are now, they're davening, they're praying to God for forgiveness. So therefore, we don't want to know which people are confessing to God that really, you know, I have sinned, I've been a bad person and everything else. And so we say it silently in order not to embarrass them. And they bring an example now from sacrifices. It's written over there, Sheharei, behold, he says, Lecholak HaKosev Mokom Ben Chatos Le'Oilo. That if you take a look, Sefer Vayikra, okay? Vayikra begins with a description, as you know, of different types of sacrifices. The first sacrifice that they mention is Oilon. And then after that they have, you know, Chatos and Oshem and things like that and so on. Okay, now, in the case of Ola, that's of course a burnt offering, right? And then what is Chatos? Chatos, as we learned, this is a sin offering brought when you realize that you've committed a sin and you want to atone for it. Okay. So, in either case, if we would take a look in the Mishnah, Izehu Mekomon, which some of us still say to this day, right? So it's written over there, where in the altar was the Oila sacrifice? The answer is it was Tzofon, because the Torah says, V'shochad l'soh al-yerach ha-mizbeach Tzofona, on the side of the altar which is facing the north. Okay, so on the northern side, this is where the Oila had to be sacrificed. And then, the question of Chatos is written over there, B'mekom ma'asheh yishachet Okay. In other words, where the same place where the Oila is sacrificed, so the sin offering also is sacrificed. So in other words, the Chatos is a sin offering, and yet we don't want to say that this man is a sinner, and so you can see that from the fact that he brought a Chatos and it was on a different side of the altar, right, which would automatically mark off that this was a sin offering. Like this, both the Ola and the Chatos are on the same side of the altar, so that to the average onlooker, they would not necessarily know what type of an animal was being brought. Was it being brought as an Ola, in other words, as a free will offering on the part of the person, right, or was it being brought as a Chatos, as a sin offering? So again, the same idea, shalol levayesh, right? In order not to embarrass somebody who is a sinner and wants to make atonement for his sin. Right. So he says, so now they come in and they say, wait a minute. He says, when it comes to saying something they call rum, we're not really trying to stress the fact that when you say Shmonesra, that you want to mention all the bad qualities b'kol rom. Why not? Because we've already said we don't want to embarrass sinners, right? So he says, you know what should be said b'kol rom? He says, lo temor genuse, right? So don't say that you shouldn't say b'kol rom genuse, in other words, you know, bad things about himself. Elo emotzaro, but rather, if a person is in distress, then he should say things aloud. Kidatanya, as we have learned, in regards to the person who is suffering from leprosy, what does the Torah say? It says, "V'tome tome yikra." In other words, he has to proclaim to whoever is passing by that I am Tomei, because, you know, I'm Mitzoron, right? Sorich lehodia. Now, why? Because we would say so that maybe we want to prevent people from coming in contact with him. But that's not the idea that we are going to read now. The idea is much more humane. It is Sorich lehodia tzara l'rabim, right? He has the obligation to proclaim his distress to the multitudes, in other words, to all the people who pass by. For what reason? V'rabim mevakshim olav rachamim. So that those people, everybody who passes by, could pray on his behalf that he should have, you know, a recovery. Okay? V'chol mi she'ir aboy dovar. Tzorch lodir l'rabim. Okay? V'rabim mevakshim olav rachamim. And whoever has, not just, you know, the business that he's a leper, but whatever is something that is a very distressing event in his life, he should proclaim to others, so let others share in his grief, so that they too could beg for rachamim, they too could pray on his behalf. Alright, gufa. Now let's get back again to something that we said just before. That's what gufa normally implies, okay? Getting back to what? Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Shum ben Yochai. The statement that we had before, that Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Shum ben Yochai, Mipnei ma tiknu tefila bilachash, right? Why did they ordain that the Shmoneh Esrei should be recited silently? Shelo levayesh hesofei aveira, right? In order not to embarrass those who are transgressors. Sha'arei lo yichulak ha'kosim mokim min chatas lo elo, inasmuch as the Torah itself did not make a difference as to where the sacrifice of the chatas or the elo was in connection with the altar. So now they say, okay, I mean, so far it's like quotation marks, right? Because we said this just a few moments ago. But now they say, wait a minute, there is a difference. What is the difference? The law, you mean to say that there is no distinction? People could tell why. The ho'ikodomim, there is a distinction, even though they're both on the same side of the altar, on the north side, but nevertheless, there's a question as to where is the blood of the sacrifice sprinkled? Dam chatos lemala. The dam olo lemata. Okay, I have to explain to you right now that the Mizbeach, the altar upon which sacrifices were offered, because I'm not talking now about the incense Mizbeach, that's a different one, okay? But the altar upon which sacrifices were offered, the Mizbeach HaOla, as we would say, excuse me, they had a red line going around the middle.
Middle part.
You know, let's say if this were the altar, okay, let's say the table was the height of the altar, okay? Actually, the altar was a little higher than that, because they had to stand on steps very often, you know, okay? But let's say that this was it. So halfway down, they painted a red line.
All around the altar.
Right, and that was called the Chut HaSikra, the red thread, literally, or the red streak, okay? Now, why? Because in some cases, the blood was sprinkled on the upper part, and in other cases, the blood of sacrifices was sprinkled in the lower part. Okay? So, although both the chatos and the ola were, you know, were sacrificed on the same side, but nevertheless, and of course the blood was sprinkled on the same side of the altar, but in the case of the chatos, the blood was sprinkled above the red line, the upper part, okay? Whereas in the case of the Yola, it was sprinkled on the lower part, okay? So the implication, therefore, is that even though the animal is on the same side, still maybe people who are standing over there could still tell whether the person who is offering the sacrifice was bringing a sin offering for something that he had committed, or whether he was bringing a free will offering, which was the case of the Ola. That's the question that they're raising now. So that's the case. How can you say that there's no differentiation, right? So he says, Gemara says, that Hosam Kohen Hu Diyoda. So he says, in that case, the Kohen is the one who knows, but not the general populace. The Kohen is busy, he shechts the, you know, and he sprinkles the blood, you understand? So he knows whether the person is bringing the animal, if it's meant for a chatos, if it's meant for an oilah. But you don't have publicity for other people, you know, that they could determine what it is. Yeah, they had different places where they did it. Right. Yeah. For that, you really have to take a look. You know, we have in Asidur, Ezel, Mekomish, Otzvochim, and you see they delineate over there, you know, where and for what and, you know, how. So take a look for a moment. Big art school. Tell you, a pleasure. Oh, the only for Shabbos, please.
How's he right?
He just came out of the nursing home.
Okay.
Thank you for asking. About a week or two, about 10 days out.
Great.
I hope you stay out this time.
Of course, in addition, they say Makoman, so, you know, besides saying where it is sacrificed, but also, all right, for example, I say Makom Shal Zvochim, so the first thing is Kodshe Kodosh, in other words, those that are among the holiest, so they are sacrificed Shitosun Basofen, right? They have to be slaughtered in the north side of the altar, right? And then he lists several of them, as the par, Basur Shayom HaKippurim, and so on, it's over there, and so on, okay.
Isn't it Yizeu?
Yizeu, right. Now, the same thing is true for some of the others, but it's also in the north part, okay. And then the Chatos, so and they explain, first of all, what are the Chatos that have to be brought on behalf of the community, and those that have to be brought on behalf of an individual. But again, the same thing, what's it say? Shechitosu Matzofon, right? The kibul domin bichli shalis batzofin. In other words, it has to be done in the north, right? And then, you know, they go around and they sprinkle on each of the corners and so on and so forth. Now, it doesn't say over here whether it's on top or below. Mishnah doesn't say that. Why? Doesn't say that for the simple reason that we have Gemaras that deal with that. You have the Gemara Zvachim, great big Gemara, which deals specifically with, you know, the subject of sacrifices, where they were brought, what did the coin have to do, and so on and so forth. So this is only an indication over here. But anyway, Olor is also in the north, right? And then you have the Oshem, and the Oshem too was in the north. They didn't mention the Oshem over here. The Oshem is a trespass offering, which was brought for certain specific things. For example, if you stole, you have to make restitution, but at the same time also you bring a sacrifice in order to atone for that. So that was an osham, okay? And instead of sprinkling it on each and every corner, what they did is to sprinkle here and make sure that the blood splashed on two sides, and then on the opposite one they did, and so on and so forth. All right, then they have other things, okay? But as I say, with here it doesn't mention specifically whether it's Lamalo or Lamata, but the Gemara is Zvachim, this is particularly where you would find where it would be. All right. So at any rate, from our point of view right now, the only important thing is the fact that for the time being, we're trying to establish as to whether a person, you know, whether a person's actions will cause them to be embarrassed by virtue of the fact that other people know the reason, you know, why he's bringing the sacrifice. And so, as we said before, in the case of the Ola, right, so the Ola being a free will offering, naturally, if there would be bystanders over there, they would think, well, this man's a very generous man, he wants to give a sacrifice, bring the sacrifice to place the victim. On the other hand, if they know that the guy is bringing a chatos, then they'll say, yeah, he's a sinner, that's the reason why he's bringing it. Yeah. So we don't want to cause embarrassment, okay? So the first thing that they made, the first point that they made, is that they're both on the same side, so that presumably the ordinary person wouldn't know, right? But now we say, oh, wait a minute, it's not that easy. Maybe people could figure it out by other things. Well, first we said, no, only the kohen knows. And nobody else knows. But we say, wait a minute, I have other things to tell me whether it is an Ola or whether it is a Chatos. Example. Okay. The Ikar Chatos the Keva, right? And Ola Zohar. So he says, look, there is a difference between an animal which is brought as a Chatos, which could be a female animal, okay, in comparison to the Ola, which must always be a Zohar. It always has to be a male, so that any person who is familiar with anatomy could sort of figure out as to whether what is being brought is an Ola, because the animal is a male, as compared to the Chatos, because the animal is a female. So he says, Hasapna, I can brush aside that one. Why? He says, Hasan, in the case of an animal, particularly see, we're talking about a sheep, is it a male sheep or a female sheep? He says, look, in the case of a sheep, Mirfayab Aya, you know, the sheep has a great big tail that hangs down. So in that particular case, then the genitals of the animal is really covered by the tail. Yeah. So in that case, then again, the question of embarrassment would not arise because of the fact that you can't tell looking at the animal from the rear as to whether it is a male or a female animal. Okay. So it says, okay, tinach kivso. Okay, good. I'll grant you that this is true as far as a kivso. Kivso is a lamb, okay? A lamb, a sheep, or something, because they have the tail, so you can't tell. But he says, how about Sehiro, my ikolamema? What if the animal, however, that he wants to bring is a female goat?
They don't have
that long tail.
They have a short tail.
Right. So he says, Hasam, Ihu the Kom Nichsef Nafshe, the boy Leilu Yisui Kivso. So he says, look, he brought it upon himself that he's bringing embarrassment. Why? He's bringing embarrassment because he should have brought a Kivso. That's the kind of an animal that he should have brought. He should have brought, in other words, a sheep. And the Komaisi Sirva, on the other hand, what does he bring? He brings a goat. So, since he's bringing an animal which is a little bit inferior, you understand? So, he's thereby letting himself be known that when he's bringing it as a Chatos, right, so that everybody can tell that.
So he's embarrassed.
Right. So now they say, well, wait a minute. Let's take something else. It says, Chatos, that but is